Okay, we've been now examining. Oh.
Thank you.
Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa. We've been examining the shorter discourse on the simile of the elephant's footprint. And just to recapitulate, the Buddha is now set out to show what he calls the true application, the true and complete application of the simile of the elephant's footprint. He is correcting what he says is the mistaken application of the simile of the elephant's footprint by the wanderer Pilotika, which had been related to him by the Brahmin Janusoni. And now the Buddha is going to build up gradually to the explication of the simile of the elephant's footprint. And he does so by laying down what is called in the text the gradual training, anupubhasita. And this is the complete course of training, of spiritual training, leading all the ways to the final goal of early Buddhism, the attainment of complete liberation. And in the schematism of the gradual training, which I have laid out in the outline, I put the first category as being certain preconditions for the gradual training. And the first of these is that a Buddha arises in the world and teaches the Dhamma. And this precondition is described in the text by a certain fixed formula, the first part of which I discussed last week, that is the formula which describes the arising or appearing of the Buddha in the world, and which enumerates the 10 primary principal qualities or epithets of the Buddha. Those terms for the Buddha which convey his special qualities, those qualities which enable him to function as the revealer of liberating truth. And from this description, it might appear as though a Buddha appears in the world fully enlightened, but from other texts in the Majjhima Nikaya, we know that the Buddha did not appear under such conditions, but that he appeared as a human being who had to undergo his own quest and struggle for enlightenment. But by virtue of his own prior training over many, many past lives, he had acquired all of the spiritual perfections, the qualities that later come to be called paramis or paramitas, which enable him upon attaining enlightenment to attain enlightenment as a Sammasambuddha, a perfectly enlightened one, one who has the qualifications, the capacity to disclose the Dhamma in its fullest dimensions, in its full breadth, majesty, and detail to the world. And so all of these functions of the Buddha are summed up in this formula of 10 epithets, 10 titles or designations of the Buddha, which I explicated last week. And now we continue, we come to the next sentence. Something I don't, I'll read the translation, though there's something I don't like in it. Okay. He declares this world, actually there are several things I don't like in it now. He declares this world with its gods, its Maras and its Brahmas, this generation with its recluses and Brahmins, its princes and its people, which he has himself realized with direct knowledge. The first thing I don't like in comparison with the Pali is that the phrase which he has himself realized with direct knowledge comes at the end in the translation. This isn't a Pali class, but let me just take the liberty of reading the Pali. Ah, yeah, now I know. Okay, so, yeah. You know, what I don't like is that he declares this world comes at the beginning, but in the Pali it comes, so imang lokang sa devakang, sa marakang sa brahmakang, sa samana brahmaning pajang, sa deva manusang sayang abhinya sachi katva pave deiti. But this is the way I would now render the Pali. Having realized himself with direct knowledge this world with its devas, Mara, Brahma, this population rather than generation, it's this whole community of living beings, having realized this population with its, now I refer as ascetics to recluses, with its ascetics and Brahmins, with its devas, gods and humans, he declares it. You see, the sense, the sequence in the Pali is that first he has the knowledge, the realization, then he declares it. But in the English, you have the declaring coming first, and then the not knowing realization coming afterwards. So in the Pali, it sort of builds up to like a climax. First, there comes the knowing, and it's like the world, and then you see, first comes the world, and then one layer of beings after another with its devas. The devas are here, they would be the lower gods, the gods in the heavenly realm. Then the text says samaraka, which could be just with one Mara. Mara is a particular deity who is regarded as the epitome of, or maybe not the epitome of evil. He's not the equivalent of the devil in Christianity. He's not concerned to bring people, living beings, to hell. But he is concerned to prevent people from escaping the bonds of sensuality, particularly to prevent them from gaining liberation, from attaining nibbana, nirvana. So if human beings remain happily engrossed in worldly enjoyments, he's quite satisfied. He doesn't want to leave. He doesn't have any concern to lead them to hell the way Satan in Christianity is depicted. But when anybody makes an effort to strive to break free from the bonds of sensuality, and particularly to break free from the bonds of samsara, then Mara becomes agitated. And Mara, as is depicted, whether this is myth or there's some real truth to it, he's depicted as a general or prince at the head of a whole army of little evil deities, little Maras. So when people of little merit seek to gain liberation, then big chief Mara doesn't go and try to disturb them, but he sends one of his little henchmen to create trouble for them. Like sometimes when if you sit down, you want to meditate, then suddenly you have like visions of delicious food pouring into your head, or you have itching restlessness to do this, to do that. Don't start swelling with conceits and thinking that big Mara is creating trouble for you. It's probably Mara is sending one of his little Maras, little like one of the pawns in his game, to create that trouble. Okay, and Mara, it's sometimes said, this is in the commentaries, again, the commentaries, often you have to take what they say with more than a grain of skepticism, but he's depicted as residing in the sixth, the topmost heavenly world of the sensuous realm. That's called the Paranimitta Vasavati Devaloka. That's the sixth, the highest heaven of the sensual sphere. In the Theravada tradition, he's not the ruler of that sphere. So I've seen that said in texts from the northern tradition. But in the Pali commentaries, it said that he resides in that realm somewhat like a rebel prince might reside in the realm where his father is the king, but there might be a rebel prince residing in an outlying territory of the kingdom. So he resides somewhat in the outlying districts of the sixth highest Devaloka, Deva world. Okay, then he realizes this world with its Brahmas. The Brahmas are the beings who inhabit their celestial realms or divine realms above the sensual heavenly realms. The Brahma realms are the realms which are inhabited by those beings who as humans had mastered the meditative absorption, the mundane meditative absorption, the samadhi, or dhyanas, but without having the wisdom necessary to gain any true insight into reality. So they still have, often they have a deep-rooted view of self, of the Atman, of the true I. Often they have some attachment, strong attachment to the bliss and peace of this samadhi, of this deep, tranquil absorption. And they're very powerful, so there can come a conceit centered upon that power. And they might dwell in these realms for inconceivable periods of time, that they imagine that they're dwelling in eternity. But the Buddha has seen that these realms are also anicca, impermanent. They come to an end. Okay, then the next phrase, it's gods, it's maras, it's brahmas, pajang. Here in these middle-length discourses, I think it's Nyanamoli, I think I follow Nyanamoli, it's using generation. But now generation means like, you know, the beat generation, generation X. People don't think of generation as meaning the created order. So maybe something like population might work better. What it means is seems to mean the totality of living beings in the visible order, perhaps excluding those in the higher dimensions. And then the word, we get deva repeated again, so deva manusam. So deva, the commentary explains deva, which is usually means God. The commentary explains it to mean kings and princes. So I think Nyanamoli used princes here, and then I let it stand. but I'm not really satisfied with that now. I think that's the kind of roundabout explanation. I think the intention is actually the lower gods, the gods that dwell in close proximity to the human realm. And then manusa are human beings. Oh, and then we have samana. Samanas are the ascetics, the renunciant ascetics. And then the Brahman, the priestly caste. And of course, in the India of the Buddha's time, these two groups, the ascetics and the Brahmins, would have been of special importance. I'll just think of it, if one takes ascetics, Brahmins, princes, and then the rest of humankind, that makes good sense also. I don't know. Okay, anyway, all of this, he realizes this whole world with all of its different types of living beings through direct knowledge, abhinyaya, achikatva. And then he teaches it, he reveals the nature of this world. Then he teaches, what's most important is that he discovers the Dhamma being the ultimate truth, the nature of things, as well as the path to liberation. And he teaches the Dhamma. And here the Dhamma, this is again a stock formulation, it's said to be good in the beginning, good in the middle, and good in the end. And then the commentaries give different ways of understanding beginning, middle, and end. Beginning can be understood as the basic ethical teachings of the Buddha. The middle could be understood as the teachings on mental purification, the higher development of the mind. Good in the end could be understood as the realizations that come through wisdom, the fruit of the spiritual life. And then the Dhamma is said to have two aspects. These two aspects are meaning and phrasing. I write the Pali words since they're both important. So what's extremely important is that the Buddha, in penetrating the truth of the Dhamma, he realizes many different dimensions of the Dhamma. And when he teaches it, he teaches this Dhamma by way of what he wants to disclose, to reveal, to expound, is the meaning. But it's part of the Buddha's his skill in teaching, his mastery of the means of communication, is that in conveying the meaning, he chooses the appropriate expression, means of expression, or phrasing. So he chooses the phrasing, the expression, which is appropriate for the communication of the meaning. And in choosing the phrasing, and selecting, in formulating and expressing the meaning, he does so in conformity with the inclinations, aptitudes, capacities for understanding of those to be taught, the people to be instructed. For this reason, the Buddha can use many different means of expression to convey essentially the same meaning. So we have a variety of terms in the text that convey the same idea. Just to take one simple example, amongst. Now on Saturdays, I've been explaining the 37, call them Bodhipakkhya Dhammas, aids to enlightenment. We have four Satipatthanas, four foundations of mindfulness. Then we have in the Noble Eightfold Path, right mindfulness. And we have in the five faculties, the faculty of mindfulness, the seven enlightenment factors, the enlightenment factor of mindfulness. Okay, these are different expressions, but what they amount to in terms of meaning is the same thing. And again, amongst the 37 factors of aids to enlightenment, we have the right view in the Noble Eightfold Path, Samadhi, Panyindriya, the faculty of understanding, and Dhamma Vichaya Bhojanga, the enlightenment factor of investigation of phenomena, Dhamma Vichaya Sambhojanga. Here, the terms seem very different, but when you inquire what is the substance of these three things, it's the same thing. It's the faculty of wisdom, Panya, just appearing in different modes, different aspects. Okay, so the Dhamma has the aspect of meaning and phrasing, and then the Buddha reveals what's called the Brahmacharya, here translated holy life, so maybe it carries a little flavor of Christianity, but Pali Brahmacharya is, charya is, what does it mean? Yeah. What? Yeah, on the right track. A little off track. Giving you a hint. Movement. Conduct, movement, motion. And then Brahma was the divine, so movement towards the divine. Or movement which has a divine quality to it. But then it takes on the meaning of a divine way of life, a spiritual way of life. And so the Buddha reveals this holy life or spiritual life that is utterly perfect and pure. And the two words here, again, they're very carefully chosen. That the holy life is utterly perfect, which means that, as the Buddha expounds it, that it is complete in all respects. Paripunang has the sense of completeness. And Parisudang has the sense of purity, that there's nothing defective in it, nothing impure in it. Okay, so now this much takes care of the first precondition for the gradual training. A Buddha arises in the world and teaches the Dhamma. This, we can say, is the aspect of the disclosure, the appearance of the liberator, the disclosure of liberating truth, and the revealing, expounding of the path to liberation. Now the next paragraph describes what we might take to be the ideal or perfect response to that disclosure of the truth and the path. Don't be afraid, I am not storing up sets of saffron robes in the next room. A householder or householder's son, or one born in some other clan, hears that Dhamma. On hearing the Dhamma, he acquires faith in the Tathagata. Okay, so the Dhamma is expounded, and there has to be a hearing of the Dhamma. And not simply a hearing, but the Pali word sunati, the savana sunati, implies, like the Chinese thing, it's also a listening, not just like we hear the bird singing or hear the sound of rain falling, but it's an active listening to it, a listening with the intention of understanding, a listening which is motivated by an interest, by an active concern to understand. And then that listening coupled with that intention to understand gives birth to saddha. Saddha means faith, the acquiring of faith in the Tathagata. Because now when the Buddha is expounding the higher Dhamma, yeah, we really need two of these books down. Peaceful solution to the problem. Okay, when when the Buddha is expounding the higher Dhamma, this is a teaching. He's expounding a Dhamma which leads to the transcending of the world. It's a Dhamma which goes against the grain of teaching of the worldly mind, the mind which is accustomed to move in the tracks of the world. Generally, of course, the Buddha doesn't begin with the world-transcending teaching, but he will begin with a gradual discourse intended to gradually build up faith in the listener. He'll begin by praising the merits of generosity, moral discipline, looking after one's parents, respect for elders, and so on. Till it's only when, through this practical, graduated discourse, it's only when he sees that the listener has gained confidence and trust in him that he will reveal and explain the world-transcending teaching. And it's when he explains that world-transcending teaching that deep faith will arise in the Buddha. And on acquiring that faith, then if the listener is in a position to do so, a free person, not bound up with commitment, some such reflection as this will take place. Please excuse me. Household life is crowded and dusty. The life of those gone forth is wide open. It is not easy while living in a home to lead the holy life utterly pure and perfect as a polished shell. Suppose I shave off my hair and beard, put on the yellow robe, and go forth from the home life into homelessness. So now this householder who has heard the teaching is reflecting upon the defects, the limitations in the household life, and also considering the benefits, the fruitfulness of the life of true renunciation. And you have to bear in mind that in the time of the Buddha, when one went forth into the life of a monastic, one was not living in comfortable monasteries with well provided with all the requisites of day-to-day life, but one was really living a life of total commitment to the quest for deliverance, for true wisdom and liberation. And so now, this householder, on a later occasion, how later it will be, that depends upon the person and the circumstances. Those whose faculties were very ripe, as soon as they heard the Buddha teach, they might go back to their household and ask their parents, please let me go forth. Some, if they were free from even parental ties, would immediately ask the Buddha for ordination. Others might take months, years, but at some point they'll make that decision, that bold decision to leave the safety and security of the household, and abandoning a small or a large fortune, that means accumulation of wealth, abandoning a small or large circle of relatives. He shaves off his hair and beard, puts on the yellow, actually the color is kasa. Here it's given kasayani vatani. Kasaya is like an earthy color, kind of ochre or ochre is a good color. The dyes that they use to make the robe, taken from bark of trees or from certain types of wood, which give a brownish, yellowish brown color. It's not a bright yellow. Puts on the yellow robe and goes forth from the home life into homelessness. Okay, now the Buddha teaches that within his system, there are four stages of, we call them four stages of enlightenment. I won't describe the differences now, we will come to them as we go along. And he teaches that it is possible for lay people, householders, to achieve, and to achieve three stages and to continue living as householders. The fourth stage and last stage, the stage of arhatship, can also be attained in a few instances, has also been achieved in a few instances by householders. But when they do so, in some cases it has been by householders just before dying, just on the verge of death, they achieve that final stage of enlightenment, of liberation, and then they realize final nirvana with their death, so fully liberated with their death. In the other cases, in the canonical texts of householders who achieve arhatship as householders, very soon after realizing it, they go forth into homelessness because there's no longer even the least bit of attachment to the household life. Those who reach the third stage of enlightenment live lives of celibacy. Naturally, there's just no possibility of any sensual indulgence for them anymore. But there seems to be some reason that keeps them tied to the household life. It might be some family obligation. But they have mastered many of the stages of meditation, and they have broken all the ties to the sensual world. So when they pass away, they will take rebirth in one of the special divine realms, and in those realms they will reach final nirvana. But there are large numbers of householders in the Buddha's time, and perhaps even today, who reach the first and second stages of enlightenment. But here the Buddha is going to show the path to liberation in its complete purity. And that path can be trod, followed most effectively by those who go forth into homelessness and lead the monastic life. And even those who follow the path to liberation as householders do so by, let's say, emulating or following within the house, the conditions of household life, by following to the best of their ability the path or pattern of life laid down for monastics. So they don't observe, of course, all the monastic precepts, but they follow the pattern of sila, of moral purity, of moral discipline, of meditative development and insight. The Noble Eightfold Path is the same, whether a householder or monastic. It's just the precepts different, but the basic principles of training are the same. Okay, but now the Buddha, now we've covered the four preconditions for the gradual training. And now we come into the actual training itself, which begins with the training in moral restraint. This is called sila sangvara, restraint by moral discipline, or restraint by the precepts. And the totality of the precepts, the totality or body of moral discipline, is called here in the text the noble aggregate of virtue. And the first set of precepts relates to right bodily action. Having thus gone forth and possessing the bhikkhu's training and way of life, abandoning the killing of living beings, he abstains from killing living beings. With rod and weapon laid aside, gentle and kindly, he abides compassionate to all living beings. Okay, this is the statement of the first aspect of moral discipline. And we'll see in most of these aspects, or many of these aspects of moral discipline, that there are two aspects. I think I mentioned this last year, but it's worth repeating, especially for the newcomers. There's an aspect of, I'll use the Pali words, an aspect of restraint and an aspect of what I call positive performance. So the aspect of restraint is, can you see? Okay, the aspect of Okay. The aspect of restraint is varita, from the root var. That's the aspect, that's the root you must have been talking about. And that is the aspect of restraint here, means abandoning the killing of living beings, abstaining from killing, putting down rod and weapon. Then the aspect of positive performance, positive conduct, is charita, from the root char. Have you ever seen that root before? Where have we seen it? What does it mean? Okay, so the aspect of positive, we call positive virtue, positive action, is being gentle and kindly and abiding compassionate to all living beings. Okay, then the second principle, abandoning the taking of what is not given, that is avoiding stealing. He abstains from taking what is not given. Then taking only what is given, expecting only what is given, by not stealing, he abides in purity, or you might say in honesty. So this is the positive aspect, is dwelling, living honestly. And now this, for lay followers, householders, the third precept is to abstain from sexual misconduct, which is generally understood to mean adultery or any type of forced or inappropriate sexual relations. But now for the monastic who's gone forth into the homeless life, the third principle of discipline is complete celibacy. So abandoning in celibacy, difficult word, okay. Non-celibacy, is that right? Okay, abandoning in celibacy, living apart, abstaining from the vulgar practice of sexual intercourse, he observes celibacy. That would be the aspect of positive conduct, positive performance. Okay, so these are three principles of right bodily action. And I should mention that the aspect of celibacy has been prescribed by the Buddha for the monastics because the spiritual path leading to liberation requires the overcoming of craving, the craving for sensual pleasures, and the sexual drive is probably the most powerful expression of sensual craving. Okay, now we come to the four principles of right speech. He abandons, or abandoning false speech. He abstains from false speech. That's the aspect of restraint. Then he speaks truth, adheres to truth, is trustworthy and reliable, one who is no deceiver of the world. That strong commitment to truth, to being trustworthy, that is the positive component. Okay, then one abandons malicious speech. This is speech intended to divide friendly people from each other. One abstains from malicious speech. One does not repeat words which will cause division amongst friendly people. And thus he is one who reunites those who are divided, one who promotes friendships, one who enjoys concord, rejoices in concord, and so on. That is the positive aspect. Then abandoning harsh speech, one abstains from harsh speech, the aspect of restraint, and one speaks words that are gentle, pleasing to the ear, lovable, that go to the heart, courteous, desired by many, agreeable to many, the positive aspect. Abandoning gossip, one abstains from gossip, that's the aspect of restraint. Then one speaks at the right time, speaks what is fact, speaks on what is good, speaks on Dhamma, speaks on the discipline. At the right time, one speaks words that are worth recording, reasonable, moderate, and beneficial. That's the positive aspect. Okay, now we come to a set of, call these miscellaneous principles of ethical conduct that pertain specifically to monastics, but not all of the principles that I've just mentioned in general apply to both monastics and householders, except that the third principle of right action for householders, abstaining from sexual misconduct, for monastics, observing celibacy. But what comes next are principles that generally, well, not invariably, though, most of them apply specifically to monastics, but not to householders. But some at the bottom apply to householders and monastics. Okay, he abstains from injuring seeds and plants. Now, in the Buddha's time, many people believed that seeds and plants had a kind of life faculty. And so the Jains were very particular about this. They would not injure any plants or animal, they would not injure any plants or seeds. But the Buddhists didn't believe that plants have a spirit or soul. And so they did not, in the early days, they did not really care very much whether they would pluck flowers, the Buddhist monks, or they would step on seeds when they were walking, sometimes carelessly, or when cutting fruit, they would cut the seeds. But lay people complained about this to the Buddha, and so the Buddha laid down the precept that monks should not destroy seeds and plants. So it's not because the Buddha believed that the seeds and plants have consciousness or a soul, but this was to satisfy people who had such a conviction and to conform to the standards of conduct observed by ascetics at the time of the Buddha. So this became a kind of principle of etiquette amongst the Buddhist monastics. Okay, and then he practices eating only one meal a day, abstaining from eating at night and outside the proper time. Now, the Buddha himself made it the practice to eat only in the forenoon, and he laid down the rule for the monastics to take food only in the forenoon. And so, even in the Theravada countries today, this rule is still observed. So in the northern countries, it's been modified because of the climate there. But there are still, even in Sri Lanka, there are monks in Thailand, Burma, monks who observe the practice of taking only one meal a day. They go on alms round in the morning, just collect enough food to sustain them, and then the rest of the day they'll just take liquids. And because they're leading primarily a meditative life, then there's no more need for more sustenance. Okay, then he abstains from dancing, singing, music, theatrical shows, from wearing garlands, using scents, unguents, using high, large couches, abstaining from accepting gold and silver, In those days, gold and silver was used as currency, and it was regarded as inappropriate for ascetics to accept gold and silver. They would receive what they need as offerings from people, and that would be enough to keep them going. He abstains from accepting raw grain, since they would have no need for raw grain, since they would subsist by what they would collect on alms round. From accepting raw meat, he abstains from accepting women and girls. It seems that there were some ascetic cults that, well, I use ascetic quotes, cults in quotation marks. They were kind of wanderers, but they would demand from their followers or devotees, please give me beautiful young girls. And that would be like considered the lay people wanted to make the greatest offerings to them, they would offer them their daughters. But the Buddha had to institute this principle that no accepting women or girls. That would be like a stain on the holy life. He abstains from accepting men and women slaves, accepting goats and sheep, fowl and pigs, elephants, cattle, horses, and mares, accepting fields and land. Like the Brahmins, they would accept these things in exchange for their services. They would chant the mantras, perform ceremonies, and lay people would give them, especially the kings, the aristocrats, would give them animals, lands, fields, as gifts of appreciation. But the Buddhist monks would not be entitled to receive these things. And he does not go on errands or run messages. He abstains from buying and selling, abstains from false weights, false metals, false measures. These are principles at the bottom. These all Buddhist followers should avoid. He abstains from cheating, deceiving, defrauding, and trickery, abstains from wounding, murdering, binding, brigandage, plunder, and violence. And I group many of these rules, principles of restraint, I say in the sheet, that they relate to right livelihood. Right livelihood means not only in occupation or means of work, but it's the means by which one acquires the requisites of existence. And so a monastic has to obtain the requisites of existence in a proper way and has to receive the appropriate requisites of existence, not things which are contrary to the standards of a renunciate life. Okay, I think this will be enough for the discussion tonight. If there are questions, then please. They can eat wild fruits, but the fruits would have to be picked up and offered to them. You see, there's a principle that a monk is not entitled to take an edible item himself and then just eat it on his own. But any edible item has to be offered by being placed into his hands or placed into an object in his hands. And so if there are fruits that he wants to eat, then he could designate a person, to a lay person, to pick them and then offer them to him. You see, but it was a practice, you see, in pre-Buddhist India and in the other ascetic communities, they would go into very isolated areas, and they would just live on the fruits that would fall off the trees. But in that way, they could live in complete isolation from human contact for long periods. But it seemed the Buddha deliberately wanted to make the monastic live in a kind of dependence upon the lay community by requiring them to receive food from lay people and to receive it fresh every day. And so in this way they would have to come into contact with people, and this way they would provide an example and also give opportunities for teaching. the Dhamma to people. And that created that sort of bond of solidarity between the Buddhist monastics and the lay community, which has sustained Buddhism through the centuries. Think one is supposed to receive food that is already cooked. Yeah, I have to think about that. I don't think that is the principle. I think the principle is that one is not supposed to take raw grain back for storage. Perhaps that's the idea. Raw meat, maybe because it decays, if one keeps it. Excuse me? So, well, theoretically, if one is, say, living in a monastery and there is a lay attendant, one could bring the meat back, the raw meat, and have him prepare it. And the grain, too, in theory, it could be brought back and cooked. I'd have to look into this. It didn't occur to me to investigate that particular point. Okay. It's best to leave it untranslated. It's taken to come from the root mar, which gives us also marana, death. So Mara is the lord of death, because as the tempter, the one who leads one back into the world of sensuality, he's also the one who leads one back to repeated birth and death. Please ask the question again. Yeah. Okay. In the Buddhist cosmology, there are six sense-sphere heavenly worlds. These are, let me say, in the Buddhist cosmos, there are three basic domains of existence. Big issue here. Okay, there's the formless realm. No, it's just a realm with four planes of existence. There's no matter, no material substance there. These realms are reached through the four formless meditative attainments. There's no material substance, but there's consciousness, perception, abiding without any material body, without any material objectivity. There's individual consciousness. So it's very difficult to conceive. Then there's what is called the form realm, in which there's very subtle matter, and the beings who dwell here, they achieve this through the jhanas, the very deep states of samadhi, meditative concentration. And they dwell here in deep, most of the time in deep absorption. They have subtle material bodies. And they live for long, long periods of time. There's no sensual indulgence in these realms. But all of these are still impermanent. After many, many aeons, existence will come to an end here, and the beings will take rebirth elsewhere. The sensual realm, we have six heavenly realms. The human realm. And the human realm, we share our world with the animals who are visible to us. And then there are also what are called the ghosts or unhappy spirits. These are beings who have, after departing from the human realm with unhappy frames of mind, they dwell in close proximity to our world. Sometimes they interact with it, and they suffer from strong desires which they can never fulfill. Sometimes they're called hungry ghosts. Probably just one subgroup within this realm are really the hungry ghosts. Oh, that's a different philosophical perspective. I can't go into that now. It's not a particular realm. No.
Okay, then the hell realm, that's at the bottom here, the realm of the great suffering. Okay, let me just come to... Okay, then he asked me about the sixth heavenly realm. Okay, the realm where Mara is the sixth heavenly realm here.
This is called the realm of the deities who control the creation of others. Paraminisya Vasapati Devaloka.
This is the place where Edison, copyright lawyers, directors, film producers get reborn. Okay, and then it said that Mara, according to the Pali tradition, Mara inhabits one corner of this realm as a kind of rebel prince. He's not the ruler of the realm, but a rebel prince in one corner. But I've read in some texts, maybe from Savastivada tradition, say that he's the ruler of the sixth heavenly realm. Then the asuras, you see, in the oldest Buddhist texts, they speak about five realms. They don't count the asuras as a separate realm. But the asuras are in some way connected with the Tavatins or Triatins, or the 33, the heaven of the 33 gods. They're depicted as a class of beings in constant conflict with the 33 gods. So then later, they become sort of blocked off and counted as a separate realm. So then you get the asuras as a separate realm down here,
separate from the heavens. But in the oldest text, it seems that even in the oldest text, they're somewhat different from the devas, from the gods, since they're fighting with them. But they're just not counted as a separate class. I don't know why. Yeah, in the central realm, there are all five senses are operative, at least for the humans. I presume for the devas, there are five senses, and for all of us, the mind is always operative. Insects, maybe have other senses that we don't know about, as well as minds. All of them have minds. Except
one type of being in the form realm
temporarily doesn't have minds. Surprise! But they'll get the mind when they pass away from that. It'll come back. Yes. Anathapindikas, they were dedicated to the Sangha of the Four Quarters. They were not owned by individual monks. They were offered to the Sangha, it's called the Tathagatika Sangha, that they just belong, they're so-called Sanghika property, they belong to the Sangha. They're not property belonging to individual monks. Right. Exactly. All existence in all of these realms is impermanent. These are all realms of existence within samsara. So every realm here, every mode of existence in every realm is impermanent. There's nothing permanent here. Yes. I see. Wu bu wan qian. I know what it is. Udabasa Loka. Who is five? Who? Wubu Wantian. I see. Wubu Wantian. Non-returning. I see. That's called non-returning heaven. I see. In Pali, they're called the pure abode. Sudavasa. Yeah, they are in the form realm.
Okay, the form known has different layers, different systems, Abhidhamma systems, counts of layers differently. Now most of these are realms, they're all impermanent, but most of these are purely samsaric realms. But within the form realm there's one special block, that's a very high class block, you know, like there are these neighborhoods, they call them, you know, like in New York City, but there are some like neighborhoods where you have to use a special pass to get in. What is the term for them? Gated communities, exactly. Yeah, gated communities, right. Okay. Okay, this is a gated community. And to get into this community, you have to show a particular pass. The pass says, Anagami, non-returner, having realized non-returner as a human being, perhaps in one of the lower Deva worlds, you could also realize it. Right. So you get reborn in one of their five levels here, depending upon one's level of attainment, the degree of jhanic attainment, meditative attainment, and as a non-returner. And get reborn in here, into the pure abode. And from here, there's no falling back into any other samsara realm. From here, one could pass either directly from these realms into final nirvana, or else one could pass from a lower realm to a higher realm, till one goes to the highest realm and attains final nirvana. Tusita Devali. Yeah, what is that called in Tony? Doswai means. Yeah. Doswai is just transliteration. Just attempt to get the sound to. Doswai. Yeah, okay, Tusita is. I think it's the third or fourth. Okay. Fourth. Yeah, it's the fourth of the six heavenly worlds. Two seasons. Yeah. And it has, you think you know the details more than that. Yeah. So it has two sections, the inner realm for those who, which is sort of presided over by Maitreya Bodhisattva, for those who come, the inner court presided over by Maitreya Bodhisattva, for those who come to hear the Dhamma from him, then the outer court are those who just hear the ordinary, who just enjoy the ordinary worldly pleasures of that heavenly realm, I guess. They don't have the Dhamma connection. Is that correct? Which what? There's no I anywhere in the cosmology. Yeah. But all of the beings in the cosmos, except for those who achieve some degree of realization to the Dhamma, all conceive, they either conceive through some conceptual system the idea of I, or else they have the innate, ingrained, instinctual clinging to the notion of I, even though it's not conceptually formulated. For example, maybe animals, they don't have, I don't think they have philosophical systems that endorse or substantiate the notion of I. I overheard a couple of the deer debating this afternoon whether the I is infinite or finite. That would be what I call the instinctual and clinging to the idea of I. But it's not conceptually formulated. Like they don't have this notion that, okay, the I am the body, I am the mind, I am everlasting, the I shall after death exist in this realm, that realm.
Okay, I think we have to call it quits. Okay, we will share a few areas with them. Now that we've explained the cosmology, and also the Nagas, the Nagas are in the lowest of the six Deva worlds. We have Devas, Nagas, we're going to share the merits with them. Then we share the merit with the Devas again. The Bhutas, not all these beings fit neatly into the cosmology. The Bhutas seem to be maybe the ghosts, then with all beings in general. So first, we share the merit with all the Devas and Nagas dwelling Akasa in the sky, Bhumata, close to the earth, asking them to rejoice, then to protect the Sasana, that means the Buddha's teaching, then the Desana, that means the expounding of the Dhamma, then to protect ourselves and others. Then we invite the Devas to rejoice in the merit and achieve all success. Then we invite the Buddhas, the spirits, to rejoice in the merit and achieve all success. Then we invite all beings to rejoice in the merit and achieve all success. So we recite. Akasa ta chabuma ta deva naga mahidita punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu sasanam. Akasa ta chabuma ta deva naga mahidita punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu desanam. Akasa ta chabuma ta deva naga mahidita punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu mang parang. Etavata chaham hehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe deva anumodantu sabba sampatti siddhya. Etavata chaham hehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe bhuta anumodantu.